You're listening to The Private Citizen, a civil liberties podcast. This is episode 167 for Tuesday, the 2nd of April, 2024. The death of serious politics. Hello, everybody. My name is Fab. I'm your host. Welcome to this week's episode of The Private Citizen, which I'm once again recording in the morning or before noon, which is technically the morning. And if everything goes according to plan, I will release this right away. And you'll be listening to this within hours. Or you'll be able to. You can listen to it whenever you want. That's the beauty of podcasting. You can also watch it on YouTube. Everything you need to know is on the website, privatecitizen.press. Today, I'm recording this a little bit earlier this week. I got a lot of stuff on my plate this week. So, yeah, I'm going to get that out. I'm on the horse. I don't want to drop off the horse again. Today, we're going to talk about a story that a friend of the show sent me and I thought was interesting. It's an article. And it, I don't think the guy wanted to make this point, but it's, to me, it makes one point very clear, which is one of my pet peeves, which is that journalism is shit. So settle in for another rant about that, I guess. Well, let's get through this story. I don't think I have any other housekeeping to talk about. So let's get right to that. Today we're going to talk about an article by political scientist and writer Brian Klass, and it's called The Death of Serious Politics. So let's get into that. So this was sent to me by a good friend of the show and good friend of mine, Michael Mullen Jensen, who provided me with this article of Substack. I think it's free to read for subscribers of Brian Klass, but I also have an annotated version that I'm working off that I put in the show notes. That's at privatecitizen.press. This is just the notes I took on my tablet while I was reading it. So I'm gonna read. It's not that long, so I'm gonna read his article. I've never read anything by Brian Klass. Apparently, he has several books out. He's a political scientist from the US who works in the UK. I think he teaches at a university in London. And yeah, Mike says he really likes him. And I found this article. It was, you know, I agree with his general assessment of the situation. I don't agree with the with his conclusions from it, I guess. Probably because, you know, I'm a bit biased and I have my pet peeve. I guess, you know, we'll see about that. So I'm going to go through this and I'm going to stop and comment along the way. If you want to read along, go to privatecitizen.press. So this is The Death of Serious Politics by Brian Klass. He starts with the answer: when's the last time we had a substantive discussion about policy instead of politics? Everything is now about horse races, political rhetoric, scandals, but rarely about how to solve real problems. To this, I have to say, I agree with him that is a it's a problem that we're having in the public discourse. But I feel, and this is my personal experience, I don't know about you, and I don't know about Mike, who will probably chime in about this, which anybody free to you know, tell me their opinion about this. And I before I start, I should probably be say again, I'm very thankful to Mike for sending this in. I always say that I would like people to prompt me on stuff to do a show about, and I think this worked really well. So yeah, thanks again, Mike. Anyway, so I don't have this. I think that's a problem of our social discourse, but I don't have this problem personally. In my personal experience, because when I talk, I certainly have the problem that I don't talk about politics with a lot of people, because especially since the pandemic, a lot of people kind of either said they don't want to talk about politics at all anymore, which is kind of, it's kind of hard to be my friend if you're that kind of guy, because I also studied political science at university. I guess I didn't look this up. I guess Brian, I mean, he's teaching, so he must have gotten a degree. I didn't. But I like to talk about these things. So it's kind of hard to be my friend if you're like that. So I kind of lost all of these friends. And the other friends I talk with, whenever somebody, starts a discussion that is, you know, like about this bullshit politics stuff instead of policy, I always try to deviate directly towards policy. I found that also pisses people off because lately it's been a lot about, there was the pandemic, but lately it's been a lot about Donald Trump. And as we will see, a lot of the media on this today's episode, it's going to be a lot about Trump again. I'm sorry, but it's just what everybody's talking about, right? A lot of the media actually does these stupid BS discussions, but they don't really talk about his policies. And I feel the same about Biden. There's a lot of discussion about the person and how he's better than Trump, but not a lot about the actual policies, the stuff he's done. So I always try to directly divert any discussion to this, to these detailed points, because I think the rest is not worth talking about. And I personally don't understand why the media spends its time talking about. Well, I do understand it. You know, it's a successful business model. But as a journalist, you know, if your interest is, I mean, this is why I quit, right? This is why I quit my day job as a journalist and became freelance because where I was working was the same thing. It wasn't about politics, but it was, we never talked about journalism, like, how to write better stories. We were only talking about all the stuff around that, you know, but nobody was talking about actual how to make our journalism better. And I feel that's a problem. These people worry about money and about clicks. And I think that's something that Brian will get into as well. Anyway, let's keep going. I haven't even started really. Let's get into his point here. For many of us, it's been a while. That's not because we've tuned out. It's because politics, the art of determining who gets what, when, and how, has become subsumed by scandals, outrage, discussions of rhetoric, culture wars, and above all, focusing on who's winning and who's losing at politics rather than who's winning or losing at solving problems. Completely agree with his analysis here. Increasingly, modern governance is swayed by memes, vibes, feelings forged in ignorance and apathy for anything that requires thoughtful, sustained consideration, how to make our lives and our society substantively better. We're governed by narcissistic political influences who trade in the currencies of eyeballs and clicks rather than measuring their achievements by, say, children lifted out of poverty. I think he's right, but I don't think this is. Let me read another paragraph here, and then we'll get into that. Our political cultures encourage this grotesque state of affairs, rewarding the extremists, the zealots, the spotlight chasers, while leaving the unassuming problem solvers to languish in Sisyphean obscurity until they inevitably give up and decide to do something more productive with their talents and their time. I agree on this, but I don't think it's the it is the political culture, but why is it the political culture? I personally think it's because of the media culture, right? This has somewhat changed since like the 70s, 80s. Well, I can't really talk about the 70s, but I've lived through the 80s. I was a kid, but I was always interested in politics ever since I grew up. My dad was a politician, so I have a understanding of the 80s and 90s. And this was different, I think, because of the media. I think because the media was concentrating more on actual policy and actual, maybe not children lifted out of poverty, but, you know, actual results of what politicians did more than the scandals, right? Even thinking back to like one of the earliest news stories I lived through, even though I can't really remember much at the time because I was six. Chernobyl was in 86. I was three, I think. Anyway, Chernobyl, right? If you go back and you watch the news coverage, especially the German news coverage of this, it is much more about what has actually happened than this having happened in the Soviet Union and, you know, the political scandal surrounding that. there was certainly a lot of discussion about that later on, but like it didn't dominate the news coverage at the time. And I feel like if something like this happened today, it would be about Vladimir Putin or whoever's in charge of, you know, Soviet Russia at the time. Still the same with like September 11th. I mean, I remember that. I watched it live on TV. I remember the news coverage of that as if it was yesterday. And, you know, there was recently the anniversary. So I, you know, the 20th anniversary. So I did watch it all. Well, recently, that's some time ago now as well. But like I watched a lot of the coverage again that I watched back in the day live on CNN. And like even days after that or weeks after that, it was, I mean, there were mistakes made, you know, the security theater bullshit that came out of that. No question there. But like the media coverage was much more about what had happened, what to do about it, the fate of the people who died and all this kind of stuff. It wasn't about, oh, this is George Bush's fault, right? Or whoever. You know, somebody, how can, like, it's because we have an idiot president that this has happened. And they could have done that, right? In many ways, George Bush Jr. was as much of a bumbling fool, or could have been portrayed as much as a bumbling fool as Trump. And he was in some circles, but that was not the main media coverage of this. So I do think in the last 10 to 15 years, the media has substantially changed. Which is, I mean, you know, there's a symbiotic relationship between the media and politicians. Politicians use journalists and journalists use politicians. So it's kind of, if the media culture changes and the thing that the media cares about, the political culture will change. So I'm not denying that the political culture changed, but I don't think that is the root of the issue. And we'll get into that further in a bit here. To go on with what Brian says, we talk about politics endlessly, but almost never debate policy. Tune into the news, which is, you know, this here he gets to the point of the root of the matter. Turn into the news and you'll get a firehouse of information about political intrigue, but too often virtually no new information about the actual nuts and bolts of solutions or governance. Exactly. Because journalism is shit these days. Here are some screenshots from Monday's top news from Fox News, MSNBC, and the New York Times. You got screenshots, obviously. Notice anything? Where's the policy? Politicians are supposed to be vectors to solve our problems. They're not supposed to be the story. We are supposed to be the story. And many of our collective stories of ordinary people struggling in modern society are tragic. Not just because they involve suffering and despair, but because their suffering and despair is completely avoidable in the richest countries on the planet. It's not that we lack the resources to eliminate needless suffering, but rather that we are unable to effectively coordinate and allocate our resources. That's a maddening enough state of affairs, but it makes you want to fling stuff at a wall when you recognize that we're not even talking about how to fix that dysfunction, because our collective political brain power is focused on political stunts, horrific rhetoric, or armchair analyzing of the cynical personalities of political psychopaths. Psychopaths who would happily let thousands of faceless children go hungry if it meant getting their face into a slot on primetime Fox News and, or, you know, the New York Times, I would like to add. I agree. Again, mostly, I agree with almost everything he says, but I think he's missing the mark, because this, the root, again, I mean, I think the new root for the problem is the media, but the root on the side of the politician isn't different. I mean, politicians are supposed to be vectors to solve our problems. They're not supposed to be the story. Technically right, but you can see politicians being the story if you go as far back as, you know, I'm currently reading about the Roman Empire. If you go back to Caesar, right? I mean, he was so much of the political story of the day that he's still like, classics of world literature that were written about him, that we still read today, or that he wrote. You know, so anywhere you go, I study in history, like my kind of era, the person I found most interesting was Otto von Bismarck. And he was, in many regards, during his whole reign as chancellor, he was the story. Today you would probably compare him to Trump, and say that he had like this cult of personality, which he didn't really I feel, have at the time. He was just a very, certainly not on purpose, he was just very assertive and a very, very, very strong-willed and effective person at getting his, I mean, and he was a showman, right? So there's this very famous story when Bismarck was just a budding politician, he was sent to the Deutsche Bund back in the day. It was kind of the parliament of all the German states, which at the time were kingdoms. And one of them was actually an empire, the Emperor of Austria. And the emperor, the person who was sent to this parliament, I mean, this was kind of more like the House of Lords, I guess. The person that was sent there from Austria, because, you know, everybody, all the other states were kingdoms, and this was an empire, right? So the person sent there from the emperor was had kind of special status, and this was exemplified by the fact that he could smoke. That guy that was the only guy who was allowed to smoke in the parliamentary. I mean, we're talking 1800 something, right? So people were smoking back then, but like even in House of Parliament, I guess. But like this was like special. This was like a privilege you had because you were sent by the most powerful nation or the ostensibly most powerful nation. Now at the time, Bismarck was represented Prussia, which was on the rise. Austria was falling. Prussia was a kingdom, which was on the rise. Prussia was starting to challenge Austria. And to make this point across, even though he was relatively unknown at the time and, you know, somewhat of a young upstart politician, to make this point across, when Bismarck gave his first speech in this parliament, he very, very deliberately got to the podium, pulled out a huge cigar and lit his cigar and was smoking while he was making a speech, very publicly challenging the authority of the Austrian delegate at this point. So he was a showman, right? And this was also part, I mean, the press was very different back then. Bismarck actually had his own newspaper. All the political parties had their own newspaper. But so what I'm trying to say is that this has been a factor of politics forever. Politicians are supposed to make our lives better, but to be honest, they're in politics because they love power and they have a big ego. You can't be a politician. I mean, you can be a politician without having a big ego, but you'll be a shit politician, right? All politicians have a big ego, kind of like all journalists. But I think what has changed is that the press has concentrated on this because of the internet. Because, you know, the press was challenged in one regard by the, sorry, my voice is cracking for some reason. The only thing that will help there is whiskey, but I only have coffee because I need to drive later. So I have to make do with coffee. So please excuse my voice going, I'm starting to sound like Bob Dylan, except I can't sing, can't write songs either. So I think what has changed is that, you know, the internet challenged the press, challenged its monopolies in many ways, you know, the monopoly of having radio frequencies, of having a printing press, and the press says, okay, we're going to have to play ball. We'll have to play by the rules of the internet. And with these new analytic tools and everything, I mean, I lived through this, you know, and I saw this firsthand when I was working still in a publishing company in the editorial offices. You know, all the these analytics and everything. Now the press is so focused on clicks and this kind of stuff, and they realized that emotion is what gets people to come back to your news site. So this is why the news has shifted to be almost complete, even like the most serious, like old, you know, sober news organizations have realized this. And they're becoming, it's all the, I mean, they're writing the stories in a different way. They're not, maybe not as sensationalistic as the Rainbow Press, but everybody has noticed that and has learned that you have to, like, that emotion is the thing that makes you money. And this is why they concentrate on politics and on the drama and not on policy. Let's continue with this article. This is also one of the great but often overlooked tragedies of Trumpism. For nearly a decade, his extremism, vitriol, incitement to violence, and threats to the superstructure of American democracy have required us to fixate on him and the endless bile he spews on the bodily politic. We can't ignore it because the threat is real. I think this is where he goes off the rails, and this is where he makes the... We're now getting into territory where I think the Brian Klass makes the actual mistake that is at the cause of the problem he has identified. Because this is not about Trump. This change is not about Trump. Again, I have to say this every time because you have to. I don't like Trump. But for whatever reason, I would have never voted for him. I'm not voting in the yes, but I would have never voted for him. I don't like Trump. But for whatever reason, it may be the reason that the Trump voters say is the reason, i.e. Trump derangement syndrome, or it may just be because Trump is so horrible as everybody else says. For whatever reason, everybody's concentrating everything on Trump. Trump hasn't invented populism, okay? For some extent, the system, the political system in the US has always been a populist system. That's usually what you get when you have two parties. It's gotten worse under Trump, but I don't think it's Trump's problem because it wasn't caused by Trump. It hasn't stopped when Trump left office, right? And to, you know, this bullshit threat against democracy, you know, people, really, I do not like Trump, but real talk here for a minute. He's not a fucking dictator. He stepped down. Right? And he's now running for president again. That's not what a dictator does, right? Hitler didn't step down and then was like, oh, I'm going to run to be Reich Chancellor again. As soon as the Nazis were in power, they started to change the state, right? Or you're like fucking Lenin and you overthrow the government and kill like hundreds of millions of people. That's the other way. But, you know, dictators... You know, if you want to, you know, this is a little bit more controversial and you really want to get into it. But if you call somebody like Putin a dictator, right? I mean, there are arguments for that. One of the arguments is because he isn't losing any elections. You know, dictators don't lose elections. How can Trump be a threat to democracy? Democracy worked, got him out of office, right? Even the much vaulted insurrection on, you know, the much, much feared insurrection on January 6th didn't change that. Okay, anyway, let's get back to this. Trump is not the problem, right? Pick any president in my lifetime, right? So, George Bush Sr., I can't really remember. But I can tell you one thing. If you look at Clinton, right? You can look at Clinton, you can look at Bush, or you can look at Obama. They weren't more effective in solving problems than Trump, right? And Clinton's presidency, the end of Clinton's presidency was all about him. And, you know, was he getting blowjobs in the Oval Office? I mean, who cares? But, I mean, it started there, if it started there. I don't know. But the press, they tried to impeach him for that. You know, I personally don't care. Like, you know, whatever. I remember, you know, that he taught a whole generation of us growing up in that time that blowjobs aren't really sex, right? So that was all about him. Bush's presidency had some of these, I think, especially in the very beginning, some of the, much the same problems. It was alleged that the vote had been manipulated, right? That the election was rigged. Remember the hanging chads? That was very much like today. It was just very, like the press was just tamer at the time. No, not tamer, but they were more, I think, more they were concentrating more on facts and less on emotions. And then September 11th happened, and that, of course, like, you know, primacy of foreign policy, as we say, Primat der Außenpolitik in German. That's a political science term that means, like, you know, I mean, not, I'm not saying Bush caused September 11th, but whenever you have problems in your internal, you know, when you're head of a state and you have internal problems in the state, when you can deflect this to an external threat, either, you know, you're causing the threat, you're starting a war or whatever, or something just happens like September 11th, then people completely lose track of these domestic problems, right? It all becomes about foreign policy. And to some extent, this is what happened to Bush. But like Obama, it's the same way, right? Obama was... The press, to some extent, was focused on Obama's personality as well. It's just that they liked him. But for like his term, a lot of the U.S. press ignored his shortcomings and the things he didn't do. He promised very well. He was smart. He didn't promise this directly, but he implied very strongly that he would do away with this, you know, Patriot Act bullshit, with Guantanamo Bay, with seizing U.S. citizens abroad illegally, with FISA courts. Did he do anything of that? No. He had fucking Terror Tuesdays where he sat down with his mates on Tuesday and decided who to fucking drone. Right? But the press was focused on him being a nice guy and an awesome constitutional lawyer, and they weren't focusing on that. So, kind of the same thing as Trump. Stuff got ignored. Really bad shit that happened. I mean, the press went apeshit over Trump putting people in cages. George Bush started this shit on the southern border. George Bush Jr. created the whole DHS, the whole security apparatus, this whole border control stuff, the people that put people in those cages. He created the very cages. Obama didn't stop it. It all got worse under Obama. And then Trump came into office, and now it's suddenly all Trump's fault. The only thing he did was continuing this foreign policy. And he was talking about it, right? Obama was smart enough to just do this shit and not talk about it. But it would have been, it would have been the press responsibilities to dig this up, right? To dig this up when it happened, when the poor kids got thrown into the cages. They only dug this up because of Trump. Again, it wasn't really about the policy, it was about the person. And that's exactly part of the problem. So this making it all about Trump is exactly the problem. Because it doesn't matter if you like Trump or not, really. This is going to continue. And we saw it continue when Trump was out of office. It's not like, you know, the media suddenly regained their sanity, right? And was now reporting on policy. It's not like journalism got suddenly better under Joe Biden because the threat of Donald Trump was gone. It hasn't changed. And at the point where Donald Trump's going to die at some point, you know, the guy's old as well. So at some point, he's going to be out of politics. This is going to continue. This is not a Donald Trump problem. And to me, that's obvious. And like all these people that are making out like, some kind of the rise of populism. They're like, oh my God, as if populism was a new thing. And populism, to be honest, isn't a negative thing. Populism is just politicians promising people to do what the people want. That is the definition of populism. Actually, any good politician should be a populist. Of course, it's got a bad rap because people like the Nazis used populism to gain power and then do horrible shit. And you can do, you know, like any tool. It's a tool. It's like propaganda. It's a tool. And it is largely synonymous with propaganda because often you're just promising shit and then you're not doing it, right? But we had yesterday, unbelievably to me, on April Fool's Day, actually, the German government, and this is a topic I'm going to have to talk about at some point as well, I know, actually passed a law that weed's now legal in Germany on April 1st. I thought they were not going to do it. I thought it was an April Fool's joke, but they actually did it, apparently. The law is out. I actually looked it up. Actually, I'm going to do an episode on this probably at some point. But, like, that's populism, right? In Germany, the popular demand was fucking legalize weed. The stupid Americans did it. The Dutch have been smoking weed for, like, 50 years now. You know, just fucking legalize the stuff. And that was a populist move. And it's not, you know, you can be against it. You can be for it. I'm for it. I'm not a weed smoker, really. I mean, I'm not a weed guy at all. It's not like my drug of choice, whiskey or beer. It can be good and it can be bad. And it's not a Trump invention. Trump's just really good at it for some weird reason. I don't know why, but he is. So let's continue. But just imagine how many of our collective brain cells have been commandeered after being poisoned by Trump's hateful venom and his endless supply of pointless, avoidable authoritarian drama. Thing is, I don't think Trump wanted that drama. I think that was the press. I think Trump would have been happy without the drama. Trump just wanted to be president. He was president. He was like, I'm just going to do shit. But the press didn't fucking leave him alone. I mean, you know, I'm not really blaming the press for that. I'm blaming them for their coverage being shit. But you're not supposed to leave the president alone. That's okay. Also, he kind of started the war with the press even before he was elected. So, you know, I mean, it's a natural thing, but this is what comes out of it. This is what comes out of this dynamic. I don't think it's really Trump's fault, to be honest. I do not think really it is his fault. Whatever you think about the guy, I just don't agree with these choices here, calling it hateful venom and his endless supply of avoidable authoritarian drama. I mean, maybe, but like, I'd rather have authoritarian drama than no drama. Nobody's fucking questioning Joe Biden financing the war in Ukraine. Then you don't have any drama, but you have hundreds of thousands of people dying. Is that better? I don't know. You know, I'd rather have drama. At least there people were discussing the issues. And the other drama was just like, oh, did he pay a hooker? Who the fuck cares? That's the fucking press. Donald Trump doesn't want to have that in the press. Also, who the fuck cares? Really? Like, did he pay a hooker not to say any? Like, how many other, like, I wouldn't put it past Bill Clinton to have paid for hookers and then paid for them to shut up once he became president. Joe Biden probably has a few of those skeletons in his closet. He's been a politician since he was like 20. You know, you can make that the story, but then don't complain that it's the story. I don't get it. Like, if I have a choice between, between investigating whether a president is like unfaithful to his wife, maybe a misogynist, I don't know, has weird sexual fetishes, and investigating why major global conflicts that could lead to World War III get started and sustain and, you know, not ended. I mean, that would be my focus as a journalist. But hey, that's just me. Right. Many of us know what Covfefe refers to, even as we struggle to keep track of his 91 felony indictments, all while we debate what he really meant when he warned of a bloodbath during a rally that began with him saluting the convicted January 6th prisoners. I mean, the 91 felony indictments, this is just like a prime example, right? This is the Democrats. Like, have you actually read these indictments? I have. You know, a lot of that is like, pretty much all of it is utter bullshit. I mean, some of it is stuff you can indict somebody for, of course, yes. But like, would you, if you pick any sitting House member that's been in politics for like 20 years, they're going to have some of these. You could, the Clintons had like shit going on with real estate. I think Obama was pretty clean, to be thinking of it. Obama probably didn't have, but he must have had, they're politicians on that level. They all, have like some racist shit they said in the 60s. They did some drugs. They probably fucked somebody they shouldn't have. They did shady deals. Jesus Christ. I mean, this is the problem. You're making it, the one part of the political establishment is making the whole story about the guy who's president, who wants to become president, or his candidate, whatever, and then the press just runs with that. And I it's a bad, as Brian correctly identifies, it's a bad force in society. But I'm also really pissed off with it, not because I don't like Trump. It sounds like it, but I don't like Trump. One of the reasons I'm so pissed off with it is that the press is so obviously biased. If they were just, if the US press was just, okay, clicks and eyeballs über alles, we are fucking just go emotion all the way, they would have fucking loved the Hunter Biden laptop. Like, even if it wasn't legit, they would have reported that. The New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, they've reported loads of shit that wasn't legit, that they knew wasn't legit, that turned out not to be legit, that they didn't apologize for. They didn't fucking care. I mean, this goes back to the fucking weapons of mass destruction. With Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons of mass destruction. They don't, if it's a good story, sometimes these people don't care. Which I guess, that's how you get good stories. It's not really good journalistic practice. It's really bad. It can cause shitty things in society. But I'd respect them if they at least did it on both sides. If they weren't so fucking obviously biased. It just pisses me off. And on top of that, it's really not good to do it at all. You should, as Brian says, you should care about the policy, not the people. What is actually being done? Right? When did these invasions in Ukraine happen? Was Trump president? No. Who's actually starting these wars? Who's pulling soldiers out of wars? What was actually the border policy like under Obama and Bush compared to Trump on the southern border? On whose watch did the fucking Oxy epidemic happen? Why did it happen? Look at the pandemic measures. One of the reasons, where you could actually criticize Trump, and where I would massively criticize Trump, was actually his pandemic measures. For all the stuff he said, he did the exact same thing as all the other world leaders, as Biden did later. He didn't, the lockdowns happened on his fucking watch, right? So the thing is, if you want to get him, you can get him on the policy too, which is a lot harder. And I think he's actually not done that many really bad policy decisions people think he did. I think if you looked at Trump's 4 years and you look at Biden's 4 years and you look at what was actually accomplished, and especially from a US perspective, right, the economy and everything, I think Trump would get off a lot better than Biden, which is the problem, which is why the media in the US is not looking at that, because largely they're on Biden's side. Anyway, let's continue here. We could be solving problems instead. Yeah, except we're debating fucking Trump. And what are you doing? You're doing the same thing. What profoundly vapid waste of power of all our collective consciousness. I agree. Why it matters that we don't talk policy. because of Trump and the full-blown profit-seeking news industry embedded within the frenetic pace of American life, that's your problem. The United States is ground zero. Not Trump, the news industry. That's your problem. The United States is ground zero for the destruction of serious political discourse. I would agree. We're dopamine-addled consumers of snippets of information delivered in digestible sound bites. Everything is breaking news, but rarely is there a deep dive about why society is broken or how to fix it. I completely agree. But I think what he is not seeing is, why is this happening? It's not also the media. It is in the interest of these politicians, and I feel like of generally the people in power, I would say. You know, whether it's actual power or it's money, it's, you know, largely the same thing. It's in the interest of these people that we're distracted by all this emotional shit. And you can clearly see that in some topics that I've talked about in the past, you know. It's not climate change. There are people telling us, whether you agree with that or not, whether it, you know, as you know, I think man-made climate change is a real thing. I don't know to what degree, you know, we can argue about that. But like, we're not arguing about that. And we're not, we get told by people, not only like celebrities, but politicians, that this is the most important thing there is. And we need to solve this problem, and we're doing everything to do that. And then these same politicians fly around the world and fucking jets and have parties and what the fuck. It's just like, you know, during the pandemic, they said everybody needs to stay home, and then they themselves didn't stay home. They had like fucking parties and restaurants and you know. And the media is not looking at that, and that is the problem. In making everything about people and not about the actual policy decisions, these people get away with a lot of bullshit. That is in their interest. They can do their shit. They can rig the system so that they stay in power, that they have all the money, that they don't pay the taxes. This is why we're not lifting children out of poverty. And I'm not saying it's a conspiracy and it's orchestrated, but it's just how the system works, right? It's in the interest of the media to kind of protect these power, kind of indirectly, they're protecting these powerful people because, you know, they just pick on some of them sometimes and then generate outrage. But what it does, it just shifts the blame around, right? There's some person who gets fed to the wolves. Today it's Trump. Tomorrow it's going to be somebody else, right? Now Zelensky's the hero. Then something happened. Then Zelensky gets fed to the wolf, right? But what that does is keeping us from actually looking at the policy below. And I think one of the problems is the media and the way that journalism has turned into shit. But a definite other problem is also that the people who are in power, it's in their interest. It's in their inherent interest that we are distracted and that it stays that way. And actually, when he talks about this dopamine addle, I've actually noticed, I've for years I've tried to pull myself a bit out of social media, and I've actually succeeded a bit this year. And one of the reasons is I'm doing a lot more exercise. I'm doing a lot more sports, and I used to hate sports. Fucking, you know, I didn't do any sports for like 20 years. I played football as a kid. That's soccer for you Americans. And then I just went running once in a while, but I fucking hated it. And I've actually, through a friend who's been doing exercise since, you know, she was very, very, very young, who's continuously pushed me to you know, kind of challenge myself. I actually discovered, and I still don't, you know, things like running, I still don't enjoy. And I sometimes don't enjoy the process, but at the end, you get like this, endorphin rush, kind of. And I now understand why people actually get addicted to sports. And I might be addicted to sports myself a little bit. It's kind of weird because, you know, I'm doing Muay Thai kickboxing now, and you're kind of suffering, right? You get kicked a lot. You get like hit in the face. You get kicked on your muscles, which are already, you know, under strain, and then somebody just wham, fucking kicks you in the calf, and you're like, ah, and it like really hurts. But afterwards, you feel really good. And I think this somewhat, I don't know if endorphin rush has kind of replaced whatever like dopamine rush I got from social media. So that kind of really worked for me. But I do realize I didn't, through that, I've kind of learned, I thought like this like dopamine addiction thing with social media was bullshit. But I think I believe in it now. Like, I think I believe that that's the case, because just from pulling myself out and kind of replacing that with another rush, I think I kind of feel that it's real. It's not as high level as you get in exercise, but I think it's there. And I think you fall into a, like, if you just try to quit social media, like, you know, cold turkey, you just fall into this, you just fall into this dip and you don't really realize. So I feel Brian nearly got it here. He nearly identifies the problem here, which is the media. And then he completely loses it. We're dopamine adult consumers of snippets of information delivered in digestible sound bites. Everything is breaking news, but rarely is there a deep dive about why society is broken or how to fix it. Yeah. I regularly appear on MSNBC, NPR, and CNN, and I admire many of their journalists, producers, and hosts, but I've never been asked about policy and what we should do to fix a problem. Not once. Pundits don't have to be expert on policy. How crazy is that? It's not their fault either. And then he goes on. Like, dude, you just identified the problem. Why the fuck are you on MSNBC? And you just said that's the problem. Why don't you blame these journalists? It's, you know, of course it's their fault. Of course it's their fucking fault. I wrote that in the notes here in like all caps because I was reading that. Of course it's their fault. It is their fault. These people are causing it. And MSNBC and NPR are like on the top of the list. For this kind of shit. Yes, of course it's their fault. It's these people that are not asking you about policy. They're asking you about this bullshit, you know, emotional shit that you've correctly identified. You're just not making the mental connection, the jump, what the actual problem is. It's those people that you actually admire. It's not really their fault either. In a world of hyper-competitive for-profit news production, slow and substantive always loses because media consumers with digitally shortened attention spans just switch it off. Leave the details to the air cats. For countless millions, policy is boring, so it's easier to present our political system as though it's WWE wrestling. The spectacle is the show. Yes, it's easy. I agree with you. But that is the problem. Journalists will have, if journalism is to survive, journalists will have to find a way to do this, to do the hard thing, to tell people about the actual issues and how to fix them. Because if journalism continues on this course, mark my words, it will go away. Because we're becoming influencers, and you know it's at that point when more people listen to influencers than journalists, you might as well be an influencer, because the influencers will get all the access, they will get all the free products, because they are in the pocket of the person that influences them, right? And this is what will happen. So the only way, and I personally believe, I think of myself as a very realistic person. And I'm not very idealistic, but I've discovered, even when I left my job and I was like, I'm going to become a freelance journalist, that's not a very sensible course of action, right? But I realized that I have one very deeply held idealistic belief. I believe from the bottom of my soul that people want good journalism. People want this. And I don't know if everybody wants it, but I think a significant amount of people want good information that is well researched and well presented. And these people, I've decided, are my audience. And I don't know how big that audience is, but I will try and make a living this way. And if I can't, I guess I'll sleep under a bridge. I don't know. I will not go into PR. I mean, because if you're doing that, if you're producing shit like this, you might as well go into PR. You make more money. It's easier. And this is why journalists are doing this. He's saying it. It's easier. It's easier. That's exactly it. But I'm not in this job, and I think any good journalist is not in this job because it makes you money, a lot of money, or it's easier. And I think what he does and what a lot of people do is he confuses the interest of a publisher with the interest of a journalist. It's not the job of a journalist to make the fucking news outlet money. You're not a copywriter. You're not a PR person. You're not somebody who is supposed to sit there and do whatever his boss tells him to do to make the maximum amount of money. You are hired to investigate stories and, you know, to identify stories and then investigate them, take them where they need you, and then use language in an efficient way to fucking, you know, write, to communicate what you found in the best possible way. I'm getting very agitated. Yeah, I'm sorry. But that's just the way it is. That's what I believe a journalist is, and what the job of a journalist is. It's the job of the publisher then to turn that into money. And they make good money. You know, there's no excuse. I mean, yes, journalists get paid less and less. They're fewer journalists. You don't have the time, but you have to take the time or fucking quit. I have zero emotional, like, I have zero empathy for these people because I did it. I fucking did it. I went like, fuck this shit. You know, I have a safe job here. I make good money. I could continue down this road and let people tell me what to do and basically produce shit journalism. Or I could strike out on my own and try to fucking make it, you know, writing and producing what I think, what I would like to write, right? What I think is good for my audience and not for the money, you know, not for the company I work for. So I strongly disagree with this. It is their fault. The fact that news is turning into WWE is the fault of the people producing the news. It's not the world. It's not some nebulous, there are pressures out there, yeah, but at the end of the day, it's their fucking fault. Because they don't have the backbone, apparently, to stand up for what is right. And what kind of really annoys me is that he correctly identifies the problem. Like, he correctly identifies what it does to society, but like doesn't see why that is and who's at fault. That like also, why are you writing on Substack then? Right? Isn't that why we're writing on Substack? Isn't that why we're trying to sell our reporting, our commentary directly to our audience? So that we can give the audience, you know, that's why we use platforms like this. That's why we're trying to establish this business model to sell this shit directly to the people, you know. So because we want to get a way for people who do want quality content to pay for it, you know, to reward the people who write it, to get away from this shitty system that we have right now. Anyway. Continuing here. Consider this. How many diehard cable news viewers, people who watch hours a day, could accurately answer the question, how much money does the US government spend on foreign aid? Or what's the current top marginal income tax rate? These questions aren't gotcha trivia questions. They shape political worldviews with profound consequences for government. Yeah, just don't watch cable news. Cable news shit. For example, and don't go on cable news. For example, there's a surging strand of isolationism in the political right. Go on cable news and tell them their shit. That would be the best thing. For example, there's a surging strand, or try to argue policy even if they don't let you. For example, there's a surging strand of isolationism in the political right, particularly in the United States. Many Republicans rail against foreign aid spending. It's extravagant, wasteful, and excessive. But when researchers actually probe these views among voters, the same pattern always emerges. When Americans were asked how much of the federal budget they think spent on foreign aid, the average answer is 31%, about one in every $3. The same Americans are then asked what percentage would be appropriate. The most frequent answer hovers around 10%. In reality, foreign aid consumes less than 1% of the U.S. federal budget. In other words, the people railing against the excesses of foreign aid would, if their stated views were enacted, lead to a tenfold increase in foreign aid spending. This is complete bullshit, right? I read this and I was like, this can't possibly be right. So I looked this up, right? The US spends alone around 20% of its revenue on the military. Okay, that's not foreign aid, but I think the people you're asking are loping that into there, because what do they do with the military? They go to other countries and fight wars that are ostensibly not in the interest of the United States. They are, of course, but like the war in Iraq wasn't sold to the US public by, hey, we need fucking oil. We need the oil to be cheaper. It was sold by, hey, we need to help these poor oppressed people who live somewhere there, like these brown people in the sand, right? We need to help these people. So if I was a US voter, I would think that's foreign aid, right? And his numbers can't, like, in reality, foreign aid consumes less than 1% of the U.S. federal budget. So, I mean, it might technically be right, but, like, I looked this up. I couldn't find this number. What I did find was that Biden has spent $75 billion on the war in Ukraine, right? And I think that was, like, in the last 2 years. And that is actually more than 1%. Of this, like, 0.2% of or something of the annual budget. I'm not buying any of this. And I think that's just a shit example. I think he could have... I think he's I don't know. He's obviously a Democrat or progressive, more left-leaning. And he's like, oh, this is a dumb Republicans. I mean, how does this surprise you? The U.S. was always an isolationist nation, generally. I mean, World War II is an example. That proves the rule. But the US has some interventional tendencies since then. But generally speaking, the US has always been isolationist. That's always been a strong strain in US politics. And yes, if I was a US taxpayer, I would ask, why are you paying $75 billion on the war in Ukraine? What do I actually get out of that? The possibility of World War III and nuclear destruction? Great. Maybe we shouldn't, maybe we should spend that on the people sleeping on the street in San Francisco, or give it to people that come across the border, or whatever, But hey, knowing this, or are news junkies well informed, in air quotes? I previously wrote about the perils of knowing this, in which contentedly ignorant people lack intellectual curiosity to find out new facts that might change how they see the world. Jonathan Milicic explains it beautifully. Knowingness is why present-day culture wars are so boring. No one is trying to find out anything. There's no common agreement about the facts, and yet everyone acts as if all matters of fact are already settled. Yeah, that's a huge problem, and the huge problem is the press. I mean, their prime examples are climate change, the pandemic, and actually, just off the top of my head, thought about another one, gender equality, all this bullshit about, 47 different genders, where the press, to a large extent, blatantly ignores, biological science, the fact that for 99.9% of all humans living on this planet, there is exactly two sexes, right? And yeah, you can make up genders, and there are situations where people have, they have chromosomes that are different from those 99.9%, or they have other biological processes in their body which causes them to have no reproductive organs, both reproductive organs. I mean, you know, there's people born with two heads. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that for the vast majority of probably everybody who reads your fucking newspaper, the reality is that there's two biological sexes that determine a huge part of a person's reality, right? I don't understand why, like, people ignore this. I don't know. Is this part of this knowingness problem? Why are people not curious about the greenhouse gas effect and how climate change actually works and what the processes are and how bad it is? People are just, no, it's true. It's, you know, the science says, and we all need to buy electric cars. I mean, this is the problem. It's the fucking media not doing their job, not going, well, how bad actually is it? You know, what do these scientists actually say? Because that's hard, because you fucking have to read papers and you have to learn to read papers. And then you have to read papers that are probably alien to whatever you studied in university. And it's fucking hard. This is a hard job. One could think perhaps that the antidote to knowingness would be high news consumption. No, because the news is shit. The news is the problem, my friend. Sorry. As a vector to better understand our unimaginably complex world. But that assumption falls apart even under the lightest scrutiny. As I previously explained, sometimes use the phrase well-informed to describe the same kind of person can be classified as a news junkie. But if you know the minutiae of day-to-day horse race politics in 2024, in the 2024 presidential race, but lose sight of the bigger picture about the world and its people, are you truly well-informed? No, right? On the evening of Donald Trump's victory, you could have read anything that was published in the US news landscape, on newspapers. You could have watched TV 24/7, and you would have thought that it was almost guaranteed that Hillary Clinton would win the election. You weren't well informed. You were inundated by bullshit, by people lived in a bubble and didn't look at the actual real picture out in the country. And no matter how much of this bullshit you consume, it's just like bullshit, still bullshit. If it's like saying, well, you know, if I eat a lot of shit, it's gonna start taste like amazing Italian star, you know, chef. Cooked me a meal. No, if you just eat more shit, it'll still be shit. You know, it don't get better. It doesn't. It's shit. That's what this is. You're just eating shit, and you're wondering why you're shittily informed. Yeah, it's shit. Healthy societies keep a laser-like focus on reminding ourselves why we're tuning into political debates. Politics isn't reality television. It kind of is. It's real life. As NYU's Jay Rosen puts it, we should care about the stakes, not the odds. Why it matters rather than just endlessly debating who will win. The stakes, after all, are enormous. The decisions made by powerful people dictate not just the life chances of 8 billion humans, but also the future of our species and our planet. Well, not the planet. The planet's going to be fine. Just to quote, who was it again? I did an episode about this. Shit. Why did I forget? What the hell? Now I have to look this up. Ah, God. The planet is fine. Who was it? George Carlin? George Carlin. Planet will be fine. Planet is okay. You know, humanity itself will all be okay. If a few million people die, it's just a rounding error. With existential risk lurking with greater frequency than ever before, our endlessly complex world demands serious politics. Instead, we have shouting octoboxes of pundits on cable news, TikTok reels from incendiary randos, craven politicians who have morphed into political influencers, and populist demagogues who have tapped into a proud vein of ignorance with our ailing body politic. Yeah. So, but the threats are not what you think it is, and the problem is that, like, the threat's also not climate change. The threat we have right now the biggest threat we have right now to our very survival as a species is World War III and fucking, you know, nuclear. And how do they say in Doctor Strange? This is it, boys. Nuclear combat toe-to-toe with the Russians. I believe that's Slim Pickens, isn't it? R.I.P. Slim Pickens. You know, that's the threat. Nuclear combat toe-to-toe with the Ruskies. That's what's going to happen. That's the problem. That's a much bigger problem than climate change right now. But are we talking about that? No. Because everything's Donald Trump's fault. The scale of the problem demands not just a radical restructuring of our media ecosystem and the norms within it, but also changes in ourselves, such that we collectively consume news that covers policy and problem solving, not just political intrigue. In the meantime, we can all do our part by voting with our clicks and being stubborn about when we focus our coveted eyeballs, rewarding outlets that inform, educate, and debate solutions. He's right, right? That's why we have Substack, but it's never going to work for the majority of people. That's the problem. And this radical restructuring of the news media ecosystem, how are you going to do that? You know, become authoritarian and outlaw MSNBC. I mean, I don't like MSNBC, but like that's not the solution. You know, shoot Rachel Maddow. That's not going to solve the problem. You know, or whoever. You know, how do you want to restructure the media? Do you want to deprivatize all newspapers? That's not gonna solve the problem. Wait, my phone's... Oh, God, I fucking hate... You know, airplane mode doesn't mean airplane mode anymore, right? I put my phone into airplane mode, and it's still got, like, Wi-Fi for some reason. And it's sending me messages. Jesus. You're gonna have to turn this shit off. That's another problem. You also have to turn it off because they're doing these alerts now every other month here where it's like everything gets good. Beep, beep, beep. This is a warning alert. As if like, you know, as if the Russians attack, it's going to help me. Like the German government's like, oh, we have like, you know, they test all these sirens and air raid sirens, right? Like, what for? You know, if the Russian ICBMs are on the way, where are the bunker where I'm supposed to go? Like, and even if, it's like I've been reviewing. I got screeners for the Fallout series, Amazon's Fallout series. Can't talk about it. All NDA'd. I can't fucking. They'll shoot me. But you know, I've been watching that, and it's like, you know, been thinking about Fallout again. Like, is it actually worth going into a nuclear bunker? Right, even if you can come out 200 years later, like from the vaults, and it's an amazing bunker, like the vaults are. Like, so the world's still gonna be shit. So, yeah, fuck that. Until then, I fear that we will remain stuck on an endlessly dystopian racetrack, watching with eager anticipation as we so enthusiastically debate which political horse and jockey will win, as all our rivers dry up and all our democracies collapse. Yeah, I don't think that's going to be the case. I think our actual problem is World War III. If we can step down from that, if we can de-escalate the like cold / lukewarm / hot war with the Russians, whatever we're in, if we can escalate that a bit, then that would be a good step. And yeah, so all in all, I think he identifies what's going on, but I think he's too stuck in this idea that it's Trump's fault, and it doesn't see the obvious reason that, you know, a big part of it, group that's at fault here is just journalists, who are doing a shitty job. Anyway, thanks again to Mike for sending me this. I thought, you know, I ranted a lot, so I might seem I disagree with a lot of things, but like I just, you know, that's just I probably agree with this article 50-50. Yeah, like I just agree with everything he identifies. I just don't have a different opinion on why that is. But I think it's cool. It's important to have stuff like that, just to, you know, so I can crystallize my opinion. And I don't begrudge Brian Klass anything. Like, I think this was well written and a good piece, and you know, I'm not suggesting he's not entitled to his opinion. I just I just want to make my opinion clear. I mean, this is part of the discourse. I'm trying to do what he advocates. I'm trying to, you know, talk about the actual policy, the actual core of the matter, and not the people involved and the drama. Anyway, I enjoyed this quite a lot. So thanks, Mike, for sending me that. And if you have anything you want me to discuss or talk about, or you want to prompt me, you know, go to privatecitizen.press. You can very easily send me an email. There are encrypted ways of contacting me. Or you can just go on the forum. We can have a discussion and you can turn that into a show. That would be quite nice as well. So with that, let's get to a very short listener feedback section. Yeah, this is just going to be very, very short. This is just Yevgeny Gutsnetsov commenting on last episode where I tried to pronounce a Russian word. And unsurprisingly, I completely fucked it up. So this is how, because, you know, even though I had IPA for it, the International Phonetic Alphabet, not the beer, it's kind of, as I explained, or tried to explain to Yevgeny on the forum, it's kind of that sometimes doesn't help you if you're not used to pronouncing the actual phonemes that are in these words, because, you know, I don't have any experience with Russian, so there's a lot of sounds in Russian that you don't really use in any of the other languages I do have experience with. So I can look up how to, like, pronounce them. That's what IPA is for, but you'll still fuck it up. So this is how you say, I think this is the fourth power, like kind of the fourth estate in Russian. This is how you say that correctly.
Четвертая власть.
Kind of sounds like somebody's calling you an idiot. I can't even, you know, he can say it and I can't even follow that up.
Четвертая.
Четвертая
власть.
Власть. I can do власть.
Четвертая.
Четвертая. Четвертая. Damn, Russian isn't easy, is it? Четвертая власть.
Четвертая власть.
Четвертая власть. See, I can't even, like, that's the obvious problem. I can't even say it. If you say it, like, I probably would have to take some basic Russian lessons on how to just, like, pronounce things. Like, one of the things is, like, I learned French in school. Right? In Germany, you learn English, and then your second foreign language is either French or Russian, usually. And when you're living in West Germany, like me, it's French because, you know, next to the French. And when you were in East Germany, it was Russian because, oh, it still is, because obviously the influence of the Soviet Union back in the day. And I learned French, and I still suck at, like, I can't talk French. But I can still read it a little bit, and I can pronounce it. I can, you know, reasonably, a French person would say my pronunciation is horrible, I guess, but, like, I can kind of almost still, like, that's one of the things I retained from learning French. I would love to have that about Russian, just being able to just read words and pronounce them. Wouldn't even have to, like, you know, by read, I mean, like, learn the alphabet. Like, I kind of, you know, Yevgeny, kind of annoys me with Russian. I mean, you know, the Chinese have a good reason, or the Japanese, you know, they have a good reason to have their own alphabet. It's just kind of culturally developed. I guess at this point, the Russian alphabet did too, but, you know, the church just, I feel the Orthodox Church just introduced it to as a branding measure. And possibly to fuck people over. But, like, it was kind of like, it was, like, really, really deliberately introduced. It's not like the Japanese who went, like, we'll kind of writing Chinese characters and then we're building our own alphabet out of that. They were like, let's make an alphabet. Let's just fuck with people. If they want to learn our language, if they want to be part of the club, they're going to have to learn this whole new alphabet that we kind of cobbled together from the Greek. Anyway, I'm just bitter because I can't fucking speak Russian. Thanks for sending that in, Yevgeny. Somebody who studied linguistics, I try to get things right when I can. Within my limited skills. Anyway, thanks for that. And if you have feedback, please go to privatecitizen.press. Let me know. Right. That's it. That's it for this episode. I would like to thank everybody who supports the show and keeps it on the air. You can do so. You can go to Private Citizen Not Press. Details are on there, mainly Patreon at the moment. I'm working on some other things. I'm just currently rethinking that. I will let you know. I'm working on this concept. I'll let you know. Anyway, many thanks. No showrunner once again, but many thanks to the executive producers Butterbeans, Jaroslav Lichtblau, Michael Mullen Jensen, who also gave me the content for this week's episode. Rizal, Sandman616, and Sir Galteran. Thanks to supervising producers Avis, Bennett Piata, Dave IKN, Krunkel, and Tobias Weber. Thanks to Andrew Davidson, Astral C, Cam, Captain Eckert, Dirk Didi, Fanny Mansour, Florian Pigosh, Joe Poser, Mr. Amish, RJ Tracy, and Robert Forster. And also thanks to Jonathan, Johan Sunen, Kaisius, Ricky M, Steve Hose, and Vlad. Kind of, while I was reading this out, I had like this flashback to like a UFC event where at the end there, like John Anik always reads out like, executive producers, was it the Dom Emmanuel, blah, blah, blah. I just had a brain flash. I should go like, the reproduction of this copyrighted work is illegal. Of course it isn't. It's a podcast, so, you know. Share it, people. Anyway, thanks everybody. Also, thanks to Bitemark at bitemark.co.uk for providing the service that I use to host the show and also providing the bandwidth. I couldn't do the show without them. And I would like to thank Gegenwind Photography. Gegenwind Photography from Copenhagen for my album art picture. Thanks for that. And I'm going to leave you now with a nice little song that I found as an acoustic number. It's an orchestral song called Nebula by Christopher Mo Ditlevsen. I license this music from Epidemic Sound, and he is a very prominent guest composer on there, and I really like his music, so I'm going to play us out with that. And I'll see you probably next week. Until then, you know, aim to misbehave and try to listen to Brian Klass, and you know, try to choose where you spend your money and put your eyeballs. I know it's hard sometimes, but I do agree with Brian that we should, you know, have less drama and more substance. So try to seek that out. You know, that's also misbehaving these days, I guess. Just common sense. Common sense is misbehaving these days. Jesus.